Thank you very much, Stan, for your kind words, and again to the brethren here for the invitation to come and be a part of this effort. We're honored by that extension of that invitation and its extension, and we look forward to the week together as we study from God's Word. As we mentioned last night, as we laid the groundwork for the direction of our study this week, we are going to be building our lessons around 1 John chapter 2 and verses 15 through 17, where the Lord, through the inspired apostle, admonishes us to not love the world nor the things in the world, with the reminder that if anyone loved the world, the love of the Father is not in him. All that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride, the boastful pride of life, is not of the Father but of the world. And the world passeth away and the lust thereof, but he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. And so, in this text, we have the basis of our lessons for this week. As we looked last night at the subject of the world, and then today, as we offer somewhat of a counterpoint, when the text tells us not to love certain things, I think it's necessary that we define love, which we plan to do in this lesson, and then in our morning hour worship, talk about the proper objects of love. And so, while there are clearly improper objects, lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, pride of life, and we'll study those as we progress through the week, today we want to define our terms and then see where love should be properly expressed. And so that's the direction of our study this morning. And as we would introduce our comments, I would encourage you to turn to these verses that you see before you. As we think in terms of what it means to live a Christian life, the essential characteristics of a Christian life, love is foremost and foundational. Love is at the head of the list and the basis on which all other commandments lie. And so as it says in Matthew chapter 22 and verses 37 through 40, as Jesus was asked, what is the great commandment? He gave the answer, you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your mind. This is the great and the foremost commandment. And the second is like it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And so on these two depend the law and the prophets. In other words, everything that God said, every commandment God gave in the old covenant was based upon one or both principles. This is, sometimes people say, well, the Ten Commandments serve as the skeleton of the law. But it's more foundational than that. The two commandments, on these two commandments hang all of the law and the prophets. And so here are fundamental, foundational principles that need to be understood. And as you think about the warning given in 1 Corinthians 13 and the reminder that apart from love we are nothing, we recognize we cannot be saved apart from a proper understanding and practice of love. And so the Apostle Paul mentioned several different circumstances. If I speak with the tongue of men and of angels and have not love, I am but a sounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and by that means am able to communicate all mysteries and all knowledge but have not love, it profits me nothing. And even if he were to make the ultimate sacrifice, dying for the cause of Christ, giving his body to be burned, if I do it without love, it profits nothing. And so love then is foundational. It is the foremost commandment. Apart from it, we cannot be saved. But what does it mean to love? What do we mean? Well, in the Greek language, there is a much richer set of words to communicate various forms of love than we enjoy in the English. We have one word, the letters L-O-V-E, combined together to communicate such a wide variety and range of emotions and circumstances that it almost becomes too broad of a word. And the Greeks were thankfully more precise in their language. And so they had four distinct terms that we see employed. And the one at the top is the highest and the greatest form, agape, or the verb agapao, communicate Christian love and the very kind of love that we're talking about in our lesson today. There was also the term phileo, or phileia, or phileia, excuse me. That was the love of friendship, the love of affection, the love that is brotherly. Philadelphia, for example, the city of brotherly love, may not act like it when they're playing the Cowboys, but that is the name that they are given, or the name that they wear, and a name that's rooted in the Greek language. The word storge communicates family love, the love of affection that a mother has for a child and parents have for their children generally, that children have for their parents. And then there's the word eros, or erotic love, physical or sexual love. And so we see then a whole range of emotions. And sadly, in our language, there's often misunderstanding because our language really is inadequate to express the depth and the wide range of emotions. But the Greek is much more precise. And so we want to think along these lines in our lesson this morning, considering examples of each and then drawing some lessons about the meaning that we might discern. We'll start at the bottom because that would be oftentimes when improperly expressed, the base meaning of the word. In fact, I find it significant that never in the Bible, only once in the Septuagint or the Greek translation of the Old Testament, does that word for erotic love ever appear. And you might turn to Proverbs 7 and verse 18. We see the context there describes something illicit, something out of place, something immoral. It's not saying that physical passion properly expressed in the bonds of marriage is in any way inadequate. It is something God created. God tells us in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4 that marriage is honorable and the bed undefiled within its proper sphere. Physical passion has its place, but sadly it's often practiced outside of the boundaries God laid down. And as a result then, it becomes something that is base. But here in this passage, in Proverbs 7 and verse 18, we have the statement, "Let us drink our fill of love until morning and delight ourselves with caresses." And that is not stated by a faithful wife to her husband, but an unfaithful wife to her lover. It is, the context is where Solomon is seeking to keep his son back from illicit behavior and from giving away his honor and debasing his person. And so he speaks then of wisdom, and wisdom would call out for proper behavior and keep us back from entering into such relationships as this. And so as we think about the young man lacking sense, he's thus described in verse 7. The author says, "I saw among the naive a young man lacking sense who passed through the streets near the house of a woman who was an adulteress, who flattered with her lips, who had no sense of dedication to the vow she had made to her husband. And so in the twilight," verse 9, "in the middle of the night, in the darkness, she comes to meet him dressed as a harlot. She is cunning of heart, bolsterous and rebellious. Her feet do not remain at home." You see, she is not loyal to the covenant she made before God with her husband, but rather she is in the streets, in the squares, lurking at every corner. And so she comes across this young man, seizing him, kissing him with a brazen face. She says, "I was due to offer peace offerings. I was due to pay my vows today. Therefore, I have come out to meet you and to seek your presence earnestly, and I have found you. And so I have spread my couch with coverings, with the colored linen of Egypt, and I have sprinkled my bed with myrrh, with aloes, and with cinnamon. And so come, let us drink our fill of love until morning." Now, that is not love in any acceptable way. That is unbridled lust improperly directed. And so here we see the baseness of man when he violates the boundaries God has established. There is certainly appropriate expression for physical passion, for sexual love, but it's within the boundaries of God-recognized marriage. Marriage is honorable, and in that union that God has joined a man and a woman together, the bed is undefiled, but outside of that union it becomes base. Whoremongers and adulterers God will judge. And so we see then that word, sadly today, That's so often the obsession of people. That is the obsession of our age. We live in an age given to the lust of the flesh. We'll have more to say along the lines of describing or discussing the lust of the flesh in Monday night's lesson. But for now, notice that there is a word that used to describe physical passion, but only found once in the Greek translation of the Old Testament and never in the New, because it was equated by that time with something base and something immoral. The word storge, the second word that we see, describes family affection, the natural affection that a mother has for her children. And again, this is a word not used in Scripture except in its negative form. And in the negative, we actually can see the significance of it when it is lacking. Over in Romans 1, we see the description of the fallen world of mankind, the Gentiles who are under the curse of sin because of their base behavior. They could have known God, but they chose not to retain God in their knowledge, and so God gave them up to base and immoral behavior. And then it only snowballs. As you read the remainder of Romans 1, as you continue from verse 24 down through the end of the chapter, you see all manner of carnal and corrupt and cruel behavior described. And in verse 31 it says, now they are, among other things, without understanding, they are untrustworthy, they are without natural affection, the King James says, or the New American Standard says, they are unloving. Lacking natural affection is sadly a hallmark of a world that openly practices abortion and doesn't view the sacredness of human life as worth protecting. But because of personal choices or the inconvenience that a child might bring to a person not yet ready to accept the responsibility or acting in a way that is moral. Sadly, today we live in a society, we live in a country where abortions are practiced to the tune of 1.5 million per year, and that's been the case. Those statistics have almost remained constant for the last 30 years or so. It's a tragedy that such is the case, but it's a mark of an age in which true understanding of relationships and the natural kind of love that should exist in families is lacking on the part of so many. It is the natural protective act of a parent to guard and protect and defend their young. We see that in the animal kingdom. We ought to see that in the realm of mankind. And in loving families, you most certainly do. But sadly, there are those who are without natural affection. And so that's evidenced in the problem of abortion. It's seen in the epidemic levels of child abuse, how that children can be so mistreated by unloving parents. Sometimes it's not a parent, it's a step, or it's a live-in. It's a boyfriend that mistreats the child of the woman with whom he's living. He has no natural affection. There's no kin, there's no bond, and so there's no love. But this is a word, then, that is used here. It's used also in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 3 as it describes the difficult days that shall come and the sad state of affairs that follow men who have rejected God, men who are lovers of self, who are lovers of money, who are lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. We see that among other characteristics in verse 3, they are unloving. They have no proper sense of natural affection toward one another. The word phileo, or the noun phileia, moves up and deals with a love of affection. A love that, yes, shares some similarity with the affection found in a family, but extends beyond blood kinship. We do have natural affection toward those that are in our family, but then we can have this brotherly love toward those with whom we share relationships and have like interest. And so here's a word that is warm and tender and responds well to what we see in another person. We choose friends based on their character, based on the attitude they manifest and the way in which they interact with us. And so if someone is friendly, he that would have friends must show himself friendly, as a proverb of the Old Testament, and really speaks very directly to the nature of this kind of love. It is the love of affection that is drawn forth by the characteristics we see in others. And so we have friends with which we share much in common, with which we share happiness, and sometimes we also share sadness. We rejoice with those that rejoice. We weep with those who weep when we have this kind of brotherly love. In Luke 15, there is the parable that Jesus told, actually three related parables of the lost sheep and the lost coin and then the lost son. And regarding the first two, it says that when the shepherd goes out and retrieves the one sheep that was lost, that when he comes back in verse 6, Luke 15 and verse 6, he calls his friends together and says to them, "Rejoice." And so here, friends share in the joy of one another, both in the excitement of having recovered something of value, something that was precious, that was imperiled, as would be a sheep lost on the hillsides and lost in the wilderness. Or in verse 9, the woman that had lost a coin, and then she goes to all the trouble of sweeping her entire house until she finds it. And when she finds it, it says she calls together her friends. She calls together those with whom she shares a close relationship who would be concerned about her and who would feel her loss. And so she says, "Rejoice with me." And so friends do that very sort of thing. And that's why brethren have that kind of bond one with another. That we do rejoice with those that rejoice, and we weep with those that weep, and we have that tender compassion one for another. Now, sometimes friendship is not based on the proper standard. You can notice in Luke 23 and verse 12, the interesting statement that Herod and Pilate became friends. Sometimes the enemy of my enemy is my friend. In this case, we see they had both taken a stand against Jesus Christ. Pilate washed his hands of the matter. He wouldn't take a stand for what was right. But it says, now Herod and Pilate became friends with one another that very day on which Christ was betrayed. They were both wicked men. They previously had been alienated, but this situation brought them together. And yet it was not a friendship that would last. Neither of these men had the attitude that would contribute to any sort of permanent union one with another. They were extremely selfish, both alike. But on the other hand, in Acts chapter 10 and verse 24, we see the example of Cornelius. Here was a man who had been told by God to send to Joppa to one Peter, and he will come and tell thee words whereby thou and thy house may be saved. And so here was a good man, but he wasn't a saved man. He was still in need of hearing the gospel and obeying it. But he was a good man who had an unparalleled privilege. Go, send to this man named Peter, and he will come and preach truth to you. He will tell you words that will be life-changing and soul-saving. And what did he do? It says he called together his relatives and close friends. And they were all assembled. They were all in one place when Peter arrived. And so Cornelius says, "We are here, present before God, to hear the things commanded thee of God." And so friendship is interested in the well-being of another person. Cornelius was friends with a number of individuals. He showed a friendly attitude toward the Jews in that he had built them a synagogue. He was a very benevolent and kind leader. And yet... he wanted others to share in the blessings that were promised to him. We have an opportunity this week of coming together, of studying. At times other than the regular schedule of services, and if you have friends, invite them. They can benefit from hearing the truth preached. That was the very sort of thing that Cornelius did as he called together his relatives and his close friends. We ought to have the same attitude that was seen in Abraham. Abraham is described in James 2 and 23 as a friend of God. Abraham had warm and kindly feelings toward his Creator. He communed with God. He was close to God. And so also we must be as well. There are several passages that speak of the attitude that we should show one toward another that grow out of this spirit of phileo. And if you'll turn to Romans chapter 12, there's a statement made in verse 10 about our duty one toward another. It says, "Be devoted to one another in brotherly love." Romans 12, 10. "And give preference one to another in honor." We need to be devoted to one another. There should be a closeness that we cultivate with fellow Christians whereby we seek to make that bond ever more close, ever more meaningful, And so there should be this devotion toward one another. What's interesting in the original language there in verse 10, if I remember correctly, and I think this is accurate, the word be devoted is actually a combination of this word and that word. That in the family of God, we truly are a family. We truly should have that natural, unbidden emotion that is shared among kith and kin, shared among father and sons and daughters, mother and her children, her offspring. But here in the family of God, we are a family, and in that there needs to be a devotion expressed in brotherly love. Another passage to consider is in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 1. Hebrews 13 and verse 1. The admonition of the Hebrew writer is thus. It says, let the love of the brethren continue. It needs to be cultivated. But just like a garden, if it's not cultivated, may be overtaken by weeds, may cease to be productive, may not flourish nearly as much as potential might allow. We must also cultivate the relationship we have with one another. Not take it for granted. Not allow weeds to grow in the place of where productive relationships should lie, but rather let the love of the brethren, let brotherly love continue. Look over to Peter's epistles in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 22. The admonition is, since you have an obedience to the truth, purified your souls for a sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart. And so in this passage we see that a part of obedience involves a cultivating of the bond that we share one with another. And so we've obeyed the truth, and that brings with it a commitment that we have not only toward the God of heaven, but toward others of like precious faith, that there is a fellowship that we share. It's primarily based on our mutual commitment to the truth, but then based on that mutual commitment, we have that horizontal relationship that all believers share with one another. And so since you have in obedience to the truth purified your souls for a sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from a pure heart. And so we are admonished then to cultivate the spirit of brotherly love. And then in the second epistle that Peter wrote, again in chapter 1 and verse 7, among the list of things that he said we must diligently add to your faith, virtue, knowledge, temperance, patience, godliness, to those qualities add brotherly kindness. Verse 7. And then furthermore, love, verse 8. Brotherly kindness is this term phileo. We are to cultivate that spirit of affection. And then in addition to that, we are also to add the quality of love, agape love. And so now we've moved to the last of the words, actually the most important of them all. The word agape is a word that was used in ancient Greek. It was found in the writings of the Greek, but rarely, and without a great deal of significance. It was one they employed, but not one that they used frequently or with great emphasis. But all that changes in the gospel. All that changes in the truth of the New Testament. Here is a term taken from obscurity that was known, but now used in a way that was given greater meaning, and really the greatest meaning that one could possibly attribute is summed up in the New Testament word for love. And so as we think about that word, as we consider that word, the way I would define agape love is that we're not simply dealing with emotion, though emotions flow from it, but it is rooted in something more concrete than emotions. Emotions can come or go. But it is rooted in a principle. It is rooted in a determination of the mind, a disposition of heart, that we are going to live a certain way, and we're going to react toward people a certain way. Regardless of how they might behave, we're going to act properly. And so here is a word that describes more than emotion, but rather an expression of the will, a principle by which we live. It is the opposite of selfishness. Now, as we were noticing those other words and considered the first, the lowest form of love, physical love, eros, That is often selfish. And the improper expression of that is nothing more than selfishness. To violate the covenant of marriage, to enter into an adulterous union with another, is not seeking the highest good of another person. It's acting with selfish desire, without regard for the needs of the other person. But here is agape. It puts the needs of the other person before selfish considerations. In fact, selfish considerations vanish. And so we are dealing then with the spirit of benevolence, unconquerable benevolence, is one way in which this word is defined. Indefeatable goodwill. Or more simply, the definition I like, because it's so easy to remember, is that agape love seeks the highest good of another person. And so here we're dealing then with a principle that Jesus expressed, though he didn't use the word, in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 12. He spoke of exactly the thought when he gave the golden rule, as we oft describe it. In everything, therefore, treat people in the same way you want them to treat you, was the admonition of Jesus, for this is the law and the prophets. This is what God's will is all about, that we treat others in a manner that we would like to be treated, that we seek their highest good. We don't want other people to take advantage of us. We don't want to simply be used for their selfish ends, but we want them to have respect and regard and concern, and we would love that to be expressed properly. And so, if we are going to act in this way, seeking the highest good of another person, we will not do them harm. Romans chapter 13 and verses 8 through 10 talk about the debt we have one toward another. And it says, owe no one anything except to love one another. Because he that has loved his neighbor, he who loves his neighbor, has fulfilled the law. And then he goes back to the law. He speaks of various thou shalt nots in verses 9 and 10. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not covet. And so the Ten Commandments were stated in the negative for the most part. But yet in the stating of those prohibitions, it really was affirming a positive. In these prohibitions, or in any other commandment, verse 9, it is summed up in this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And so, love does no wrong to its neighbor. Love is therefore a fulfillment of the law. Why did God go to the trouble of saying, don't do this, and don't do that, don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't covet, don't murder? It was because he's trying to emphasize proper behavior one toward another. Seek the highest good. A person who's seeking the highest good of his neighbor, of his friend, will not take his life, will not take his wife, will not covet his property or possessions that he's gained by honorable effort, will not be filled with hatred or bitterness or act in a way that would be destructive, but rather he is going to seek the highest good of his neighbor. And in 1 Corinthians 13, we have the characteristics of agape love described, and one we would do well to reflect upon, and this could be an entire series of lessons. In fact, I'm sure Stan has preached on a number of occasions the characteristics of love. 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 4, love is patient, it is kind, it is not jealous, it does not brag, it is not arrogant, it does not act unbecomingly, it does not seek its own, it is not provoked, it does not take into account a wrong suffered, it does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices in the truth, and it bears, believes, hopes, endures all things, and it never fails. So you see, the description of agape love is basically summed up in that principle: love seeks the highest good of its object. And so here is the definition of this word. I wanted to share with you a description given from one of the reference works that I have. I won't read but just a portion of what's said, but from the Revell Bible Dictionary, which is a useful tool. If you can pick one up, it would be a good addition to your library, the Revell Bible Dictionary. In describing this word, it says this: this was a little used word in classical Greek, But agape is transformed in the New Testament into the most powerful word imaginable for love. A rare, obscure word becomes the most powerful term that you could imagine. This transformation was accomplished when the Christian community used this word to portray the love of God in Christ, and I would say by inspiration, because that must be understood. By this association, agape was lifted from the realm of natural affection to become the affirmation of an ideal. In other words, the term that we're using, as we go back to our chart, we've got a lazy clicker here. As we go back to our chart, as we look at these terms, physical, passionate love, family love that is natural and unbidden, the love of friendship that is an expression of affection and emotion, this was where the Greeks had previously spent their time and focus. And now there's a new term that's added to the mix and actually exalted above them all. And so moving beyond the realm of natural affection or of the response that grows out of our heart toward the kindly disposition of another, we see the principle of agape. That the love humans have yearned for has at last appeared in the person of Jesus Christ. In Him we discern God's love, which is sacrificial and redeeming and unmerited. Now, if I love my friend, or if I love my family, it's reciprocated. It is an emotion I feel in response to the kindness and the goodwill of another. That's the love of friendship. They feed off of one another and build one another up. But here is a word that actually transcends that, that can be directed toward an object that is unlovable, at least at its present point. And hopefully the direction of that love will change that circumstance. But God loved us while we were yet sinners, at a point at which we were not lovable in the least. If we got what we deserved, it would be judgment and death. But God was willing to act in a way based in principle, not simply in responding to something already present. And thus, we see then that agape love is an expression of the character of the one who loves, and it's not dependent upon the qualities of its object. And so when we think of that, we understand then more clearly, love your enemies. We'll talk about that more later in the lesson. In the morning hour of worship. But I want us to spend just a little time in John chapter 21. There's a text there where Jesus is seeking to restore Peter to his apostleship. Now, Peter has gone back to his former livelihood of fishing, as well as the other disciples. Peter had been a tremendous disappointment to himself. He had just sworn up and down, as sometimes we might say today, that if others defend thee, I'll never. And yet before the evening was out, he had denied his Lord three times with cursing and swearing. And at last, in the process, it wasn't simply because he was being stared down by some man three times his size, but a maiden asked or made the statement, "Weren't you one of his disciples?" He cowered in the presence of a little girl who raised an accusation against him, pointed her finger against him. He cursed and swore and said, "I know not the man." And yet as Jesus passed from one place to another on the night of his betrayal, at that very point, as he was being led from one trial to another, he was passing through the courtyard and his eyes met those of Peter as he was swearing and cursing, "I know not the man." And he heard the cock crow and he went out and wept bitterly. And that was the emotional state of Peter when he says, "I go fishing." It wasn't recreational at that point. It was despair and despondency, and he had lost his purpose. And so Jesus comes to him and calls him back to service. And so, in John 21, in verse 15, when they had finished breakfast, and Peter has recognized this is the Lord, as have the other apostles, though nothing has been said as of yet, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Do you agapao me? Do you seek my highest good? And Peter answered and said, Lord, you know that I love you, that I phileo you. There's a distinction there that's worth bringing out. Jesus is saying, Peter, are you going to act based on principle and conviction and a determination of the will? Do you love me? And all that the term for Christian love implies. Are you going to act in such a way as to seek my highest good? And Peter can't say that because Peter's failure is so much burdening him. All he can say is, Lord, you know I care about you. But he had not acted according to principle. In fact, he had done the opposite. Again, verse 16, he said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And he said, Lord, you know that I love you. Again, the same two words. Simon, do you agapao me? Lord, you know I phileo you. And the explanation or the response that Jesus gave is as he did before. We failed to notice in verse 15. It's repeated in verse 16. Tend my lambs, shepherd my sheep. He asked him a third time in verse 17. Simon Peter, do you love me? But what I find so touching here is the Lord drops it down a notch. And he uses the word Peter's using. He doesn't repeat the challenging question that only causes Peter's shame to well up all the stronger. No, Peter had not acted according to agape love. But then he lowers it. Okay, we'll meet you where you are. And that's what's so wonderful about the Lord Jesus Christ, is that he meets us where we are and takes us to where we need to be. And he meets Peter where he's at. Peter is willing to affirm his personal affection and devotion. Simon Peter, do you phileo me? And Peter's answer is, Lord, you know I do. And then the answer, again, is the same. Tend my sheep. In other words, the way that we show our affection and our will of seeking the highest good of our Lord is by seeking to further his kingdom and to shepherd his sheep or to feed his lambs. In other words, Peter was given the task of preaching the gospel. He would be a shepherd of the local congregation. We learn that from his epistle as he wrote to the elders and identifies himself as one. But he also served as a shepherd in the broader sense as an apostle. He was one who carried on the work of the good shepherd in that apostolic office. But the way that he showed his love toward God in both ways is by furthering the will of God. And so I see in that a very tender expression, a willingness of the Lord to drop down to Peter's level, to not compromise in the process, but meet him where he was. Peter honestly could not say he had acted according to the principle of love. Peter steadfastly affirmed his affection, though his practice was failed. And so dropping down to that level, all right, Peter, we'll go from there, and we'll try to build it up to where it ought to be, feed my sheep. And then we see, as we have noticed, in the writings of Peter himself, as he deals with those essential characteristics, you add to your faith virtue and knowledge and temperance and patience and godliness and brotherly kindness and also love, agapao. So you add to all of that. And so in this, what we see then is the love that God calls us to, that we are called to love. Not just emotionally, those that bring out feelings of affection, but we're called to love even those that are unlovable. John 3:16, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. He loved the world at a point at which the world was wholly and completely alienated from God. When if God had simply acted on the basis of justice, it would have obliterated the world. None of us would be here. All of us would have been destroyed and humanity ended long ago if God had simply operated on the spirit of justice. But God is not only a God of justice, he is also a God of mercy and of love. And so, being such a God, he calls us to believe and to respond to him and all that belief demands. John 14, if you'll notice there, and verses 21 and following, he who has my commandments and he who keeps them is the one who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father. And I will love him, and I will disclose myself to him. And so here we see then this statement about love. Now Judas, not Iscariot, said to him in verse 22, Lord, what has happened that you were going to disclose yourself to us and not to the world? And Jesus answered and said, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word. And my Father will love him, and we will come into him and make our abode with him. And he who does not love me does not keep my words. And the love which you and the word which you hear is not mine, but rather the Father who sent me. So here's a practical test of the love that we have toward God: is do we keep his word? Are we obedient to his will? And if we are, and if we're seeking to obey him because of our affection and our determination, our mindset that we are going to do the will of God, then that's a demonstration of the spirit that lies within us. We'll close with 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 14 reminds us, and we quoted this last night, the love of Christ controls us. It constrains us. It reaches down and grabs hold and won't let go. Having concluded this, that one died for all implies that all were dead. And that he died for all carries with it the requirement that they who live might no longer live for themselves, but rather for him who died and rose again on their behalf. When we see an expression of love, it should bring out within us a sense of responsibility. And so this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. And his commandments are not burdensome. Let us be impressed with those truths. And then as we go through the week and study about improper objects of love, having defined our terms in our class setting this hour, in the next we want to look at how love should be properly directed, and then that will give us a basis on which seeing the areas where it is prohibited as we reflect further. Appreciate your attention this morning, and we're now dismissed.